No answer. Hopley, where did the gypsies go when they left Raintree? Do you know? No answer. I have to talk to you, Billy said desperately. I've got an idea, Hopley. I think...
You can't do anything, Hopley whispered. It's gone too far. You understand, Halleck? Too far.
That sigh again. Papery. Dreadful. It's a chance, Halleck said furiously. Are you so far gone that doesn't mean anything to you? No answer. Billy waited, hunting inside himself for more words, other arguments. He could find none. Hopley simply wasn't going to let him in. He had begun to turn away when the door clicked open. Billy looked at the black crack between the door and the jamb. He heard those rustling movements again, now going away, back down the darkened front hall. He felt goose flesh scutter down his back and sides and arms, and for a moment he almost went away anyhow. Never mind, Hopley, he thought. If anyone can find those gypsies, Kirk Pensley can, so never mind, Hopley. You don't need him. You don't need to see what he's turned into. Pushing the voice back, Billy grasped the knob of the police chief's front door, opened it, and stepped inside. He saw a dim shape at the far end of the hall. A door on the left opened. The shape went in. A dim light glowed, and for a moment, a shadow stretched long and gaunt across the hall floor, bending to go halfway up the far wall, where there was a framed photograph of Hopley receiving an award from the Fairview Rotary Club. The shadow's misshapen head lay on the photograph like an omen. Billy walked down the hall, spooked now, no use kidding himself. He half expected the door behind him to slam shut and lock. And then the gypsy will dart out of the shadows and grab me from behind, just like the big scare scene in a cheap horror movie. Sure, come on, asshole, get your act together. But his trip-hammering heartbeat did not slow. He realized that Hopley's little house had an unpleasant smell, low and ripe, like slowly spoiling meat. He stood outside the open door for a moment. It looked like a study or a den, but the light was so faint it was impossible to tell for sure. Hopley?
Come in,
the papery voice whispered. Billy did. It was Hopley's den, all right. There were rather more books than Billy would have expected, and a warm Turkish rug on the floor. The room was small, probably cozy and pleasant under the right circumstances. There was a blonde wood desk in the center. A tensor lamp stood on it. Hopley had bent the lamp's neck so that the shade was less than an inch from the desk blotter. There was a small and savagely concentrated circle of light on the blotter. The rest of the room was a cold land of shadows. Hopley himself was a man-like bulk in what might have been an Eames chair. Billy stepped over the threshold. There was a chair in the corner. Billy sat in it, aware that he had picked the chair in the room which was farthest from Hopley. Nevertheless, he found himself straining to see Hopley clearly. It was impossible. The man was nothing but a silhouette. Billy found himself almost waiting for Hopley to flip the tensor lamp up so that it glared into his, Billy's, eyes. Then Hopley would lean forward, a cop out of a 1940s film noir screaming, "We know you did it, McGonagall. Stop trying to deny it. Confess. Confess, and we'll let you have a cigarette. Confess, and we'll give you a glass of ice water. Confess, and we'll let you go to the bathroom." But Hopley only sat canted back in his Eames chair. There was a soft rustle as he crossed his legs.
"Well, you wanted to come in. You're in. Tell your tale, Halleck, and get out. You're not exactly my favorite person in all the world these days."
"I'm not Leader Rossington's favorite person either," Billy said. "And frankly, I don't give much of a shit what she thinks or what you think either. She thinks it's my fault. Probably you do, too.
How much did you have to drink when you hit her, Alec? My best guess is that if Tom Rangeley had given you the breathalyzer, that little balloon would have floated straight up to heaven.
Nothing to drink. No drugs, Billy said. His heart was still thudding, but now it was powered by rage rather than fear. Each thud sent a sick bolt of pain through his head. You want to know what happened? Huh? My wife of 16 years picked that day to give me a hand job in the car. She never did anything like that before. I don't have the slightest clue why she picked that day to do it. So while you and Lita Rossington, and probably Carrie Rossington as well, have been busy laying it off on me because I was behind the wheel, I've been busy laying it off on my wife because she had a hand inside my pants. And maybe we should all just lay it off on fate or destiny or something and stop worrying about blame. Hopley grunted. Or do you want me to tell you how I begged Tom Rangeley on my knees for him not to give me a breath test or a blood test? How I cried on your shoulder to soft-pedal the investigation and kick those gypsies out of town? This time Hopley didn't even grunt. He was only a silent, slumped shape in the Eames chair. Isn't it just a little late for all these games? Billy asked. His voice had hoarsened, and he realized with some astonishment that he was on the verge of tears. My wife was jerking me off, true. I hit the old woman and killed her, true. She herself was at least 50 yards from the nearest crosswalk and came out from between two cars, true. You soft-pedaled the investigation and hustled them out of town as soon as Carrie Rossington slapped a quick coat of whitewash on me, also true, and none of it means shit. But if you do want to sit here in the dark and hand out the guilt, my friend, don't forget to give yourself a plateful.
A great closing summation, Halleck. Great. You ever seen Spencer Tracy in that movie about the monkey trial? You must have. Fuck you, Billy said and got up.
Hopley sighed.
Sit down.
Billy Halleck stood uncertainly, realizing that part of him wanted to use his anger for its own less than noble purposes. That part wanted to get him out of here in a manufactured huff, simply because that dark, slumped shape in the Eames chair scared him shitless.
Don't be such a sanctimonious prick, Hopley said. Sit down, for Christ's sake.
Billy sat down, aware that his mouth was dry and that there were small muscles in his thighs which were jumping and dancing uncontrollably.
Have it the way you like it, Halleck. I'm more like you than you think. I don't give a fart and a high wind for the postmortems either. You were right. I didn't think, I just did it. They weren't the first bunch of drifters I ever busted out of town, and I've done other little cosmetic jobs when some hot shit townie got involved in a mess. Of course, I couldn't do anything if the townie in question made the mess outside the Fairview town limits. But you'd be surprised how many of our leading lights never learned that you don't shit where you eat. Or maybe you wouldn't be surprised.
Hopley uttered a gasping, wheezy laugh that made goosebumps rise on Billy's arms.
All part of the service. If nothing had happened, none of us, you, me, Rossington, would even remember those gypsies ever existed by now.
Billy opened his mouth to utter a hot denial, to tell Hopley that he would remember the sick double thud he'd heard for the rest of his life. And then he remembered the 4 days at Mohonk with Heidi, the two of them laughing together, eating like horses, hiking, making love every night, and sometimes in the afternoons. How long had that been after it happened? 2 weeks? He closed his mouth again.
What's happened has happened. The only reason I let you in at all was that it's good to know someone else believes this is happening, no matter how insane it is. Or maybe I just let you in because I'm lonely. And I'm scared, Alec. Very scared. Extremely scared. Are you scared?
Yes, Billy said simply.
You know what scares me the most? I can live like this for quite a while. That scares me. Mrs. Callagy does my grocery shopping, and she comes in twice a week to clean and do the washing. I've got the TV, and I like to read. My investments have done very well over the years, and if I'm moderately frugal, I could probably go on indefinitely. And just how much temptation to spend does a man in my position have, anyway? Am I going to buy a yacht, Halleck? Maybe charter a Lear and fly to Monte Carlo with my honey to watch the Grand Prix race there next month? What do you think? How many parties do you think I'd be welcome at, now that my whole face is sliding off?
Billy shook his head numbly.
So, I could live here and it would just go on, like it's going on right now, every day and every night. And that scares me, because it's wrong to go on living like this. Every day I don't commit suicide. Every day I just sit here in the dark watching game shows and sitcoms. That old gypsy fuck is laughing at me.
When did he
touch me? Just about 5 weeks ago, if it matters. I went up to Milford to see my mother and father. I took them out to lunch. I had a few beers before and a few more during the meal and decided to use the men's room before we left. The door was locked. I waited. It opened, and he came out. Old geezer with a rotted nose. He touched my cheek and said something.
What?
I didn't hear it, Hopley said. Just then, someone in the kitchen dropped a whole stack of plates on the floor, but I didn't really have to hear it. All I've got to do is look in the mirror.
You probably don't know if they were camped in Milford.
As a matter of fact, I checked that out with the Milford PD the next day, Hopley said. Call it professional curiosity. I recognize the old gyp. No way you're going to forget a face like that, you know what I mean?
Yes, Billy said.
They had been camped on a farm in East Milford for 4 days. Same sort of deal as the one they had with that hemorrhoid Arncaster. The cop I talked to said he'd been keeping pretty close tabs on them, and that they appeared to have moved on just that morning.
After the old man touched you?
Right.
Do you think he knew you were going to be there, in that particular restaurant?
I never took my folks there before, Hopley said. It was an old place that had just been renovated. Usually we go to a Dago place way on the other side of town. It was my mother's idea. She wanted to see what they did to the rugs or the paneling or something. You know how women are.
You didn't answer my question. Do you think he knew you were going to be there? There was a long, considering silence from the slumped shape in the Eames chair.
Yes, Hopley said at last. Yes, I do. More insanity, Halleck, right? Good thing no one's keeping score, isn't it?
Yes, Billy said. I guess it is. A peculiar little giggle escaped him. It sounded like a very small shriek.
Now, what's this idea of yours, Halleck? I don't sleep much these days, but I usually start tossing and turning right around this time of night.
Asked to bring out in words what he had only thought about in the silence of his own mind, Billy found himself feeling absurd. His idea was weak and foolish, not an idea at all, not really, but only a dream. The law firm I work for retains a team of investigators, he said. Barton Detective Services, Inc.
I've heard of them.
They are supposed to be the best in the business. That is to say, he felt Hopley's impatience radiating off the man in waves, although Hopley did not move at all. He summoned what dignity he had left, telling himself that he surely knew as much about what was going on as Hopley, that he had every bit as much right to speak. After all, it was happening to him, too. I want to find him, Billy said. I want to confront him. I want to tell him what happened. I guess I want to come completely clean. Although I suppose if he could do these things to us, he may know anyway.
Yes,
Hopley said. Marginally encouraged, Billy went on. But I still want to tell my side of it. That it was my fault, yes. I should have been able to stop in time. All things being equal, I would have stopped in time. That it was my wife's fault, because of what she was doing to me. That it was Rossington's fault for whitewashing it, and yours for going easy on the investigation and then humping them out of town. Billy swallowed. And then I'll tell them it was her fault, too. Yes. She was jaywalking, Hopley. And so, okay, it's not a crime they give you the gas chamber for. But the reason it's against the law is that it can get you killed the way she got killed.
You want to tell him that?
I don't want to, but I'm going to. She came out from between two parked cars, didn't look either way. They teach you better in the third grade.
Somehow I don't think that babe ever got the officer-friendly treatment in the third grade, Hopley said. Somehow I don't think she ever went to the third grade, you know.
Just the same, Billy said stubbornly. Simple common sense.
Alec, you must be a glutton for punishment,
the shadow that was Hopley said.
You're losing weight now. Do you want to try for the grand prize? Maybe next time he'll stop up your bowels, or heat your bloodstream up to about 110 degrees, or...
I'm not just going to sit in Fairview and let it happen, Billy said fiercely. Maybe he can reverse it, Hopley. Did you ever think of that?
I've been reading up on this stuff, Hopley said. I guess I knew what was happening almost from the time the first pimple showed up over one of my eyebrows. Right where the acne attacks always started when I was in high school. And I used to have some pisser acne attacks back then, let me tell you. So I've been reading up on it. Like I said, I like to read. And I have to tell you, Alec, there are hundreds of books on casting spells and curses, but very few on reversing them.
Well, maybe he can't. Maybe not. Probably not, even. But I can still go to him, goddammit. I could stare him in the face and say, "You didn't cut enough pieces out of the pie, old man. You should have cut out a piece for my wife, and one for your wife. And while you're at it, old man, how about a piece for you? Where were you while she was walking into the street without looking where she was going? If she wasn't used to in-town traffic, you must have known it. So where were you? Why weren't you there to take her by the arm and lead her down to the crosswalk on the corner? Why?"
"Enough," Hopley said. "If I was on a jury, you'd convince me, Halleck. But you forgot the most important factor operating here."
"What's that?" Billy asked stiffly.
"Human nature. We may be victims of the supernatural, but what we're really dealing with is human nature. As a police officer, excuse me, former police officer, I couldn't agree more. There's no absolute right and absolute wrong. There's just one gray shading into the next, lighter or darker. But you don't think her husband's gonna buy that shit, do you?"
"I don't know."
"I know," Hopley said. "I know, Halleck. I can read that guy so well I sometimes think he must be sending me mental radio signals. All his life he's been on the move. Busted out of a place as soon as the good folks have got all the Mary Jane or hashish they want, as soon as they've lost all the dimes they want on the wheel of chance. All his life he's heard a bad deal called a dirty gyp. The good folks got roots. You got none. This guy, Halleck, he's seen canvas tents burned for a joke back in the 30s and 40s, and maybe there were babies and old people that burned up in some of those tents. He's seen his daughters or his friends' daughters attacked, maybe raped, because all those good folks know that gypsies fuck like rabbits and a little more won't matter, and even if it does, who gives a fuck? To coin a phrase, he's maybe seen his sons or his friends' sons beaten within an inch of their lives. And why? Because the fathers of the kids who did the beating lost some money on the games of chance. Always the same. You come into town, the good folks take what they want, and then you get busted out of town. Sometimes they give you a week on the local pea farm or a month on the local road crew for good measure.
And then, Halleck, on top of everything, the final crack of the whip comes. This hot-shot lawyer with three chins and bulldog jowls runs your wife down in the street. She's 70, 75, half-blind. Maybe she only steps out too quick because she wants to get back to her place before she wets herself, and old bones break easy. Old bones are like glass. And you hang around thinking, maybe this once, just this once, there's gonna be a little justice. An instant of justice to make up for a lifetime of crap.
Quit it, Billy Halleck said hoarsely. Just quit it. What do you say?
He touched his cheek distractedly, thinking he must be sweating heavily. But it wasn't sweat on his cheek. It was tears.
No, you deserve it all, Hopley said with savage joviality. And I'm gonna give it to you. I'm not telling you not to go ahead, Halleck. Daniel Webster talked Satan's jury around, so, hell, I guess anything's possible. But I think you're still holding on to too many illusions. This guy is mad, Halleck. This guy is furious. For all you know, he may be right off his gourd by now, in which case you'd be better off making your pitch in the Bridgewater Mental Asylum. He's out for revenge. And when you're out for revenge, you're not apt to see how everything is shades of gray. When your wife and kids get killed in a plane crash, you don't want to listen to how Circuit A fucked up Switch B and Traffic Controller C had a touch of Bug D and Navigator E picked the wrong time to go to Shithouse F. You just want to sue the shit out of the airline or kill someone with your shotgun. You want a goat, Halleck. You want to hurt someone. And we're getting hurt. Bad for us, good for him. Maybe I understand the thing a little better than you, Halleck.
Slowly, slowly his hand crept into the narrow circle of light thrown by the tensor lamp and turned it so that it shone on his face. Halleck dimly heard a gasp and realized it had come from him. He heard Hopley saying, "How many parties do you think I'd be welcome at, now that my whole face is sliding off?" Hopley's skin was a harsh alien landscape. Malignant red pimples the size of tea saucers grew out of his chin, his neck, his arms, the back of his hands. Smaller eruptions rashed his cheeks and forehead. His nose was a plague zone of blackheads. Yellowish pus oozed and flowed in weird channels between bulging dunes of proud flesh. Blood trickled here and there. Coarse black hairs, beard hairs, grew in crazy, helter-skelter tufts, and Halleck's horrified, overburdened mind realized that shaving would have become impossible some time ago in the face of such cataclysmic upheavals. And from the center of it all, helplessly embedded in that trickling red landscape, were Hopley's staring eyes. They looked at Billy Halleck for what seemed an endless length of time, reading his revulsion and dumbstruck horror. At last he nodded, as if satisfied, and turned the tensor lamp off. "Oh, Christ, Hopley, I'm sorry."
"Don't be,"
Hopley said, that weird joviality back in his voice.
"Yours is going slower, but you'll get there eventually. My service pistol is in the third drawer of this desk, and if it gets bad enough, I'll use it no matter what the balance is in my bank book. God hates a coward, my father used to say. I wanted you to see me so you'll understand. I know how he feels, that old jip, because I wouldn't make any pretty legal speeches. I wouldn't bother with any sweet reason. I'd kill him for what he's done to me, Halleck."
That dreadful shape moved and shifted. Halleck heard Hopley draw his fingers down his cheek, and then he heard the unspeakable, sickening sound of ripe pimples breaking wetly open. "Rossington is plating. Hopley's rotting, and I'm wasting away," he thought. "Dear God, let it be a dream. Even let me be crazy, but don't let this be happening."
"I'd kill him very slowly," Hopley said. I will spare you the details.
Billy tried to speak. There was nothing but a dry croak.
I understand where you're coming from, but I hold out very little hope for your mission,
Hopley said hollowly.
Why don't you consider killing him instead, Halleck? Why don't you?
But Halleck had reached his limit. He fled Hopley's darkened study, cracking his hip hard on the corner of his desk, madly sure that Hopley would reach out with one of those dreadful hands and touch him. Hopley didn't. Halleck ran out into the night and stood there breathing great lungfuls of clean air, his head bowed, his thighs trembling. He thought restlessly for the rest of the week of calling Ginelli at Three Brothers. Ginelli seemed like an answer of some kind. Just what kind, he didn't know. But in the end, he went ahead and checked into the Glassman Clinic and began the metabolic series. If he had been single and alone, as Hopley was — Hopley had made several guest appearances in Billy's dreams the night before — he would have canceled the whole business. But there was Heidi to think about. And there was Linda. Linda, who truly was an innocent bystander and who understood none of this. So he checked into the clinic, hiding his crazy knowledge like a man hiding a drug habit. It was, after all, a place to be, and while he was there, Kirk Pensley and the Barton Detective Services would be taking care of his business. He hoped. So he was poked and prodded. He drank a horrid, chalky-tasting barium solution. He was given X-rays, a CAT scan, an EEG, an EKG, and a total metabolic survey. Visiting doctors were brought around to look at him as if he were a rare zoo exhibit. A giant panda, or maybe the last of the dodo birds, Billy thought, sitting in the solarium and holding an unread National Geographic in his hands. There were band-aids on the backs of both hands. They had stuck a lot of needles in him. On his second morning at Glassman, as he submitted to yet another round of poking and prying and tapping, he noticed that he could see the double stack of his ribs for the first time since high school? No, since forever. His bones were making themselves known, casting shadows against his skin, coming triumphantly out. Not only were the love handles above his hips gone, the blades of his pelvic bones were clearly visible. Touching one of them, he thought that it felt knobby, like the gear shift of the first car he had ever owned, a 1957 Pontiac. He laughed a little, and then felt the sting of tears. All of his days were like that now. Upsy-downsy, weather unsettled, chance of showers.
I'd kill him very slowly, he heard Hopley saying. I will spare you the details.
Why, Billy thought, lying sleepless in his clinic bed with the raised invalid sides.
You didn't spare me anything else.
During his 3-day stay at Glassman, Halleck lost 7 pounds. Not much, he thought, with his own brand of gallows joviality.
Not much. Less than the weight of a medium-sized bag of sugar. At this rate, I won't fade away to nothing until, gee, almost October. 172, his mind chanted. 172 now. If you were a boxer, you'd be out of the heavyweight class and into the middleweight. Would you care to try for welterweight, Billy? Lightweight? Bantamweight? How about flyweight?
Flowers came. From Heidi, from the firm. A small nosegay came from Linda. Written on the card in her flat, sprawling hand was, "Please get well soon, Daddy. Love you, Lynn." Billy Halleck cried over that. On the third day, dressed again, he met with the three doctors in charge of his case. He felt much less vulnerable in jeans and a Meet Me in Fairview T-shirt. It was really amazing how much it meant to be out of one of the goddamn hospital johnnies. He listened to them, thought of Lita Rossington, and suppressed a grim smile. They knew exactly what was wrong with him. They were not mystified at all. Au contraire. They were so excited, they were damn near making wee-wee in their pants. Well, maybe a note of caution was in order. Maybe they didn't know exactly what was wrong with him yet, but it was surely one of two things, or possibly three. One of them was a rare wasting disease that had never been seen outside of Micronesia. One was a rare metabolic disease that had never been completely described. The third, just the possibility, mind you, was a psychological form of anorexia nervosa. This last, so rare, that it had long been suspected but never actually proven. Billy could see from the hot light in their eyes that they were pulling for that one. They would get their names in the medical books. But in any case, Billy Halleck was definitely a rara avis, and his doctors were like kids on Christmas morning. The upshot was that they wanted him to hang in at Glassman for another week or two, or possibly three. They were going to whip what was wrong with him. They were going to whip it good. They contemplated a series of megavitamins to start with, certainly, plus protein injections, of course, and a great many more tests, without a doubt. There was the professional equivalent of dismayed howls, and they were almost literally howls when Billy told them quietly that he thanked them, but he would have to leave. They remonstrated with him. They expostulated. They lectured. And to Billy, who felt more and more often lately that he must be losing his mind, the trio of doctors began to look eerily like the Three Stooges. He half expected them to begin bopping and boinking each other, staggering around the richly appointed offices with their white coats flapping, breaking things and shouting in Brooklyn accents. "You undoubtedly feel quite well now, Mr. Halleck," one of them said. "You were, after all, quite seriously overweight to begin with, according to your records. But I need to warn you that what you feel now may be spurious. If you continue to lose weight, you can expect to develop mouth sores, skin problems. If you want to see some real skin problems, you ought to check out Fairview's chief of police," Halleck thought. "Excuse me, ex-chief." He decided, on the spur of the moment, and apropos of nothing, to take up smoking again. "Diseases similar to scurvy or beriberi," the doctor was continuing sternly, "you're going to become extremely susceptible to infections, everything from colds and bronchitis to tuberculosis." "Tuberculosis, Mr. Halleck," he said impressively. "Now, if you stay here..." "No," Billy said. "Please understand that it's not even an option." One of the others put his fingers gently to his temples as if he had just developed a splitting headache. For all Billy knew, he had. He was the doctor who advanced the idea of psychological anorexia nervosa. "What can we say to convince you, Mr. Halleck?" "Nothing," Billy replied. The image of the old gypsy came unbidden into his mind. He felt again the soft, caressing touch of the man's hand on his cheek, the scrape of the hard calluses. "Yes," he thought, "I'm going to take up smoking again. Something really devilish, like Camels or Pall Malls or Chester Foggies. Why not? When the goddamn doctors start looking like Larry, Curly, and Moe, it's time to do something." They asked him to wait a moment and went out together. Billy was content enough to wait. He felt that he had finally reached the caesura in this mad play, the eye of the storm. And he was content with that. That, and the thought of all the cigarettes he would soon smoke, perhaps even two at a time. They came back, grim-faced, but looking somehow exalted, men who had decided to make the ultimate sacrifice. They would let him stay free of charge, they said. He need pay only for the lab work. "No," Billy said patiently. "You don't understand. The major medical coverage pays for all of that anyway. I checked. The point is I'm leaving, simply leaving, bugging out." They stared at him, uncomprehending, beginning to be angry. Billy thought of telling them how much like the Three Stooges they looked, and decided that would be an extremely bad idea. It would complicate things. Such fellows as these were not used to being challenged, to having their gree-gree rejected. He did not think it past possibility that they might call Heidi and suggest that a competency hearing was in order. and Heidi might listen to them. "We'll pay for the test, too," one of them said finally, in a this-is-our-final-offer tone.
"I'm leaving," Billy said. He spoke very quietly, but he saw that they finally believed him. Perhaps it was the very quietness of his tone that had finally convinced him that it was not a matter of money, that he was authentically mad.
"But why? Why, Mr. Halleck?"
"Because," Billy said, "although you think you can help me, gentlemen, you can't." And looking at their unbelieving, uncomprehending faces, Billy thought he had never felt so lonely in his life. On his way home, he stopped at a smoke shop and bought a package of Chesterfield Kings. The first three puffs made him feel so dizzy and sick that he threw them away.
"So much for that experiment," he said aloud in the car, laughing and crying at the same time. "Back to the old drawing board, kids."
Linda was gone. Heidi, the normally tiny lines beside her eyes and the corners of her mouth now deep with strain, she was smoking like a steam engine, Billy saw, one vantage 100 after another, told Halleck she had sent Linda to her Aunt Rhoda's in Westchester County.
"I did it for a couple of reasons," Heidi said. "The first is that she needs a rest from you, Billy, from what's happening to you. She's half out of her mind. It's gotten so I can't convince her you don't have cancer."
"She ought to talk to Carrie Rossington," Billy muttered, as he went into the kitchen to turn on the coffee. He needed a cup badly, strong and black, no sugar. "They sound like soulmates."
"What? I can't hear you."
"Never mind, just let me turn on the coffee."
"She's not sleeping," Heidi said when he came back. She was twisting her hands together restlessly. "Do you understand?"
"Yes," Billy said, and he did. But it still felt as if there was a thorn lodged somewhere inside of him. He wondered if Heidi understood that he needed Linda, too, if she really understood that his daughter was also part of his support system. But part of his support system or not, he had no right to erode Linda's confidence, her psychological equilibrium. Heidi was right about that. She was right about that no matter how much it cost. He felt that bright hate surface in his heart again. Mommy had driven his daughter off to Auntie's house as soon as Billy had called and said he was on his way. And how come? Why? Because the boogie daddy was coming home. Don't run screaming, dear. It's only the thin man.
Why that day? Why did you have to pick that day?
Billy, are you all right? Heidi's voice was oddly hesitant.
"Jesus, you stupid bitch. Here you are married to the incredible shrinking man, and all you could think to ask is if I'm all right?"
"I'm as all right as I can be, I guess. Why?"
"Because you looked strange for a minute."
"Did I? Did I really? Why that day, Heidi? Why did you pick that day to reach into my pants after all the prim years of doing everything in the dark?"
"Well, I suppose I feel a little strange almost all the time now," Billy said, thinking,
"You've got to stop it, my friend. This is pointless. What's done is done."
But it was hard to stop it. Hard to stop it when she stood there smoking one cigarette after another, but looking and seeming perfectly well and...
"But you will stop it, Billy, so help me."
Heidi turned away and stubbed her cigarette out in a crystal ashtray. "The second thing is, you've been keeping something from me, Billy. Something to do with this. You talk in your sleep sometimes. You've been out nights. Now I want to know. I deserve to know." She was beginning to cry.
"You want to know?" Halleck asked. "You really want to know?" He felt a strange, dry grin surface on his face.
"Yes. Yes."
So Billy told her. Houston called him the following day, and after a long and meaningless prologue, he got to the point. Heidi was with him. He and Heidi had had a long chat. "Did you offer her a toot for the human snoot?" Halleck thought of asking and decided that maybe he had better not. The upshot of their long chat was simply this. They thought Billy was just as crazy as a loon. "Mike," Billy said, "the old gypsy was real. He touched all three of us, me, Carrie Rossington, Duncan Hopley. Now, a guy like you doesn't believe in the supernatural. I accept that. But you sure as shit believe in deductive and inductive reasoning. So you've got to see the possibilities. All three of us were touched by him. All three of us have mysterious physical ailments. Now, for Christ's sake, before you decide I've gone crazy, at least consider the logical link."
"Billy, there is no link.
I've talked to Lita Rossington. She says Carrie is in the Mayo being treated for skin cancer. She says it's gone pretty far, but they're reasonably sure he's going to be okay. She further says she hasn't seen you since the Gordon's Christmas party." "She's lying." Silence from Houston. And was that the sound of Heidi crying in the background? Billy's hand tightened on the telephone until the knuckles grew white. "Did you talk to her in person or just on the phone?"
"On the phone? Not that I understand the difference that makes."
"If you saw her, you'd know. She looks like a woman who's had most of the life shocked right out of her." "Well, when you find out your husband has skin cancer and it's reached the serious stage, have you talked to Carrie?"
"He's in intensive care. People in intensive care are allowed telephone calls only under the most extreme circumstances."
"I am down to 170, Billy said. "That's a net loss of 83 pounds, and I call that pretty extreme." Silence from the other end. Except for that sound that might be Heidi crying. "Will you talk to him? Will you try?"
"If his doctors allow him to take a call, if he'll talk to me, yes. But Billy, this hallucination of yours, it's no fucking hallucination."
"Don't shout, God, don't do that." Billy closed his eyes.
All right," Houston soothed. "This idea, is that a better word?
All I wanted to say is that this idea is not going to help you get better. In fact, it may be the root cause of this psychoanorexia, if that's really what you're suffering from, as Dr. Yount believes."
"You..." "Hopley," Billy said.
Sweat had broken out on his face. He mopped his brow with his handkerchief. He had a flicker flash of Hopley, that face that really wasn't a face anymore, but a relief map of hell. Crazy inflammations, trickling wetness, and the sound, the unspeakable sound when he raked his nails down his cheek. There was a long silence from Houston's end.
"Talk to Duncan Hopley. He'll confirm..."
"I can't, Billy. Duncan Hopley committed suicide 2 days ago. He did it while you were in the Glassman Clinic. Shot himself with his service pistol." Halleck closed his eyes tightly and swayed on his feet. He felt as he had when he tried to smoke. He pinched his cheek savagely to keep from fainting dead away.
"Then you know," he said with his eyes still closed.
"You know, or someone knows. Someone saw him."
"Grand Lawler saw him," Houston said. "I called him just a few minutes ago."
Grand Lawler. For a moment, Billy's confused, frightened mind didn't understand. He believed that Houston had uttered a garbled version of the phrase grand jury. Then it clicked home. Grand Lawler was the county coroner. And now that he thought of it, yes, Grand Lawler had testified before a grand jury or two in his time. This thought brought on an irrational giggling fit. Billy pressed his palm over the phone's mouthpiece and hoped Houston wouldn't hear the giggles. If he did, Houston would think he was crazy for sure.
"And you'd really like to believe I'm crazy, wouldn't you, Mike? Because if I was crazy and I decided to start babbling about the little bottle and the little ivory spoon, why, no one would believe me anyway, would they? Goodness, no."
And that did it. The giggles passed.
"You asked him?"
"For a few details concerning the death.
After the horror story your wife told me, you're damn right I asked him.
Houston's voice grew momentarily prim.
You just ought to be damned glad that when he asked me why I wanted to know, I hung tough.
What did he say?
That Hopley's complexion was a mess, but nothing like the horror show you described to Heidi. Grand's description leads me to believe that it was a nasty outbreak of the adult acne I'd treated Duncan for off and on ever since I first examined him back in 1974. The outbreaks depressed him quite badly, and that came as no surprise to me. I'd have to say that adult acne, when it's severe, is one of the most psychologically bruising, non-lethal ailments I know of.
You think he got depressed over the way he looked and killed himself?
In essence, yes.
Let me get this straight, Billy said. You believe this was a more or less ordinary outbreak of the adult acne he'd had for years. But at the same time, you believe he killed himself because of what he was seeing in the mirror. That's a weird diagnosis, Mike.
I never said it was the skin outbreak alone, Houston said.
He sounded annoyed.
The worst thing about problems is the way they seem to come in pairs and trios and whole gangs, never one by one. Psychiatrists have the most suicides per 10,000 members of the profession, Billy, but cops aren't far behind. Probably there was a combination of factors. This latest outbreak could have been the straw that broke the camel's back.
You should have seen him, Billy said grimly. That wasn't a straw. That was the fucking World Trade Center.
He didn't leave a note, so I guess we'll never know, will we?
Christ, Billy said and ran a hand through his hair. Jesus Christ.
And the reasons for Duncan Hopley's suicide are almost beside the point, aren't they?
Not to me, Billy said. Not at all.
It seems to me that the real point is that your mind played you a nasty trick, Billy. It guilt-tripped you. You had this bee in your bonnet about gypsy curses, and when you went over to Duncan Hopley's that night, you simply saw something that wasn't there.
Now Houston's voice took on a cozy, you-can-tell-me tone. Did you happen to drop into Andy's pub for a couple before you went over to Duncan's house? Just to, you know, get yourself up for the encounter a little?
No.
You sure?
Heidi says you've been spending quite a bit of time in Andy's.
If I had, Billy said, your wife would have seen me there, don't you think? There was a long period of silence. Then Houston said colorlessly,
That was a damned low blow, Billy. But it's also exactly the sort of comment I'd expect from a man who is under severe mental stress.
Severe mental stress, psychological anorexia. You guys have got a name for everything, I guess. But you should have seen him. You should have...
Billy paused, thinking of the flaming pimples on Duncan Hopley's cheeks, the oozing whiteheads, the nose that had become almost insignificant in the gruesome erupting landscape of that haunted face. Billy, can't you see that your mind is hunting a logical explanation for what's happening to you? It feels guilt about the gypsy woman, and so...
The curse ended when he shot himself, Billy heard himself saying. Maybe that's why it didn't look so bad. It's like in the werewolf movies we saw when we were kids, Mike. When the werewolf finally gets killed, it turns back into a man again.
Excitement replaced the confusion he had felt at the news of Hopley's suicide and Hopley's more or less ordinary skin ailment. His mind began to race down this new path, exploring it quickly, ticking off the possibilities and probabilities.
Where does a curse go when the cursee finally kicks it? Shit, might as well ask where a dying man's last breath goes, or his soul. Away. It goes away. Away, away, away. Is there maybe a way to drive it away?
Rossington. That was the first thing. Rossington, out there at the Mayo Clinic, clinging desperately to the idea that he had skin cancer because the alternative was so much worse. When Rossington died, would he change back to...
He became aware that Houston had fallen silent, and there was a noise in the background, unpleasant but familiar. Sobbing? Was that Heidi sobbing?
Why is she crying? Billy rasped. Billy, put her on. Billy, if you could hear yourself, God damn it, put her on. No, I won't. Not while you're like this. Why, you cheap coke-sniffing little... Billy, quit it!
Houston's roar was loud enough to make Billy hold the phone away from his ear for a moment. When he put it back, the sobbing had stopped.
Now listen, Houston said. There are no such things as werewolves and gypsy curses. I feel foolish even telling you that.
Man, don't you see that's part of the problem? Billy asked softly. Don't you understand that's how these guys have been able to get away with this stuff for the last 20 centuries or so?
Billy, if there's a curse on you, it's been laid by your own subconscious mind. Old gypsies can't lay curses.
But your own mind, masquerading as an old gypsy, can.
Me, Hopley and Rossington, Halleck said dully, all at the same time. You're the one who's blind, Mike. Add it up.
It adds up to coincidence and nothing more. How many times do we have to go around the mulberry bush, Billy? Go back to the Glassmen. Let them help you. Stop driving your wife crazy.
For a moment, he was tempted to just give in and believe Houston. The sanity and rationality in his voice, no matter how exasperated, were comforting. Then he thought of Hopley turning the tensor lamp so that it shone savagely up onto his face. He thought of Hopley saying, "I'd kill him very slowly. I will spare you the details."
"No," he said. "They can't help me at the Glassmen, Mike."
Houston sighed heavily.
"Then who can? The old gypsy?"
"If he can be found, maybe," Halleck said. "Just maybe. And there's another guy I know who might be of some help. A pragmatist like you."
Ginelli.
The name had surfaced in his mind as he was speaking. "But mostly I think I've got to help myself."
"That's what I've been telling you."
"Oh, I was under the impression you just advised me to check back into the Glassmen clinic."
Houston sighed. "I think your brains must be losing weight, too. Have you thought about what you're doing to your wife and daughter? Have you thought about that at all?"
"Did Heidi tell you what she was doing to me when the accident happened?" Billy almost blurted out.
"Did she tell you that yet, Mikey?"
"No. Oh, you ought to ask her. My, yes."
"Billy?"
"Heidi and I will talk about it," Billy said quietly.
"But don't you..."
"I think you were right about at least one thing, Mike."
"Oh? Well, good for me. And what was that?"
"We've gone around the mulberry bush enough," Billy said, and hung up the telephone.
But they didn't talk about it.
Billy tried a couple of times, but Heidi only shook her head, her face white and set, her eyes accusing him. She only responded once. It was 3 days after the telephone conversation with Houston, the one in which Heidi had been sobbing accompaniment in the background. They were just finishing dinner. Halleck had put away his usual lumberjack's meal, 3 hamburgers, with buns and fixins, 4 ears of corn, with butter, 1/2 pint of French fries, and 2 helpings of peach cobbler with hard sauce. He still had little or no appetite, but he had discovered an alarming fact. If he didn't eat, he lost more weight. Heidi had arrived back home following Billy's conversation, argument, with Houston, pale and silent, her face puffed from the tears she had cried in Houston's office. Upset and miserable himself, he had skipped lunch and dinner, and when he weighed himself the next morning, he saw that he had plummeted 5 pounds to 167. He stared at the figure, feeling a coldly fluttering swirl of moths in his gut. 5 pounds, he thought. 5 pounds in one single day. Christ! He had skipped no more meals since then. Now he indicated his empty plate, the clean corn cobs, the remains of the burgers, salad, French fries, dessert.
"Does that look like anorexia nervosa to you, Heidi?" he asked. "Does it?"
"No," she said unwillingly. "No, but I've been eating like this for the last month," Halleck said. "And in the last month, I've lost just about 60 pounds. Now, would you like to explain how my subconscious managed that trick? losing 2 pounds a day on an intake of roughly 6,000 calories per 24 hours? I don't know, but Mike says...
You don't know and I don't know, Billy said, tossing his napkin into his plate angrily. His stomach was groaning and rolling under the weight of food he had dumped into it.
And Michael Houston doesn't know either.
Well, if it's a curse, why isn't anything happening to me? She shrieked at him suddenly.
And although her eyes blazed with anger, he could see the tears that were starting up in them. Stung, scared, and temporarily unable to control himself, Halleck shouted back,
Because he didn't know, that's why. That's the only reason. Because he didn't know.
Sobbing, she pushed her chair back, almost fell over, and then fled from the table. Her hand was pressed to the side of her face as if she had just come down with a monstrous headache.
Heidi, he yelled, getting up so fast he knocked his chair over. Heidi, come back.
Her footsteps didn't pause on the stairs. He heard a door slam shut, not their bedroom door. Too far down the upstairs hall. Linda's room, or the guest room. Halleck was betting on the guest room. He was right. She didn't sleep with him again during the week before he left home. That week, the last week, had the consistency of a confused nightmare in Billy's mind when he tried to think about it later. The weather turned hot and oppressive and surly, as if dog days had come early this year. Even crisp, cool, double-knit lantern drive seemed to wilt a bit. Billy Halleck ate and sweated and ate, and his weight settled slowly but surely through it all. At the end of the week, when he rented an Avis car and left, heading up Interstate 95 toward New Hampshire and Maine, he was down another 11 pounds to 156. During that week, the doctors from the Glassman Clinic called again and again. Michael Houston called again and again. Heidi looked at Billy from her white-ringed eyes, smoked, and said nothing. When he spoke of calling Linda, she only said in a dead, brittle voice, "I'd prefer you didn't do that." On Friday, the day before he left, Houston called again. "Michael," Billy said, closing his eyes, "I've already stopped taking calls from the Glassman doctors. I'm going to stop taking them from you if you don't cut the shit."
"I wouldn't do that just yet," Houston said. "I want you to listen to me very carefully, Billy. This is important."
Billy listened to Houston's new rap with no real surprise, and only the deepest, dullest stirrings of anger and betrayal. Hadn't he seen it coming, after all? Heidi had been in again. She and Houston had had a long consultation that had ended with more tears. Houston had then held a long consultation with the Three Stooges at the Glassman Clinic. "Not to worry, Billy, it's all covered by professional privilege." Houston had seen Heidi again. They all thought that Billy would perhaps profit from a battery of psychiatric tests.
"I want to urge you most strongly to take these of your own free will," Houston finished.
"I bet. And I also bet I know where you'd like me to take the tests. At the Glassman Clinic, right? Do I win a Cupid doll?"
"Well, we thought that was the logical..."
I see. And while they're testing my brains, I assume the barium enemas will continue?" Houston was eloquently silent.
"If I say no?" "Heidi has legal recourse," Houston said carefully. "You understand?"
"I understand," Billy said. "You're talking about you and Heidi and the Three Stooges there at the Glassman Clinic getting together and committing me to Sunnyvale Acres, basket weaving our specialty."
"That's pretty melodramatic, Billy. She's worried about Linda as well as about you."
"We're both worried about Linda," Billy said. "And I'm worried about Heidi as well. I mean, I have my moments when I'm so angry with her that I feel sick to my stomach, but I mostly still love her, and so I worry. You see, she's misled you to a degree, Mike."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"I know you don't, and I'm not going to tell you. She might, but my guess is that she won't. All she wants to do is forget the whole thing ever happened, and filling you in about certain details she may have overlooked the first time around would get in the way of that. Let's just say that Heidi's got her own guilt trip to work out. Her cigarette consumption is up from a pack a day to 2.5.
A long pause, and then Mike Houston returned to his original chorus.
However that might be, Billy, you must see that these tests are in the best interests of everyone on...
Goodbye, Mike, Halleck said, and hung up softly.
Billy spent the rest of the afternoon stewing his way back and forth through the air-conditioned house, catching glimpses of his new self in mirrors and polished surfaces.
How we see ourselves depends a lot more on our conception of our physical bulk than we usually think.
He found nothing comforting in this idea at all.
My sense of what I'm worth depends on how much of the world I displace as I walk around?
Christ, that's a demeaning thought.
That guy Mr. T could pick up an Einstein and lug him around all day under one arm like a school book or something.
Does that make Mr. T somehow better, more important?
A haunting echo of T.S. Eliot chimed in his head like a faraway bell on Sunday morning.
That is not what I meant. That is not what I meant at all.
And it wasn't. The idea of size as a function of grace or intelligence, or as a proof of God's love, had gone out around the time that the obesely waddling William Howard Taft had turned the presidency over to the epicene, almost gaunt, Woodrow Wilson.
How we see reality depends a lot more on our conception of our physical bulk than we usually think.
Yes, reality. That was a lot closer to the heart of the matter. When you saw yourself being erased, pound by pound, like a complicated equation being erased from a blackboard line by line and computation by computation, it did something to your sense of reality. Your own personal reality. Reality in general. He had been fat. Not bulky, not a few pounds overweight, but downright pig fat. Then he had been stout. Then just about normal, if there really was such a thing. The Three Stooges from the Glassman Clinic seemed to think there was, anyway. Then thin. But now thinness was beginning to slip into a new state. Scrawniness. What came after that? Emaciation, he supposed. And after that, something that still lingered just beyond the bounds of his imagination. He was not seriously worried about being hauled away to the funny farm. Such procedures took time. But the final conversation with Houston showed him clearly just how far things had gone and how impossible it was that anyone was going to believe him, then or ever. He wanted to call Kirk Pinchley. The urge was nearly insurmountable. Even though he knew Kirk would call him when and if any of the three investigative agencies the firm employed had turned up something. He called a New York number instead, paging to the back of his address book to find it. Richard Ginelli's name had bobbed uneasily up and down in his mind since the very beginning of this thing. Now it was time to call him. Just in case.
Three brothers, the voice on the other end said. Specials tonight include veal marsala and our own version of fettuccine alfredo.
My name is William Halleck, and I would like to speak to Mr. Ginelli if he's available. After a moment of considering silence, the voice said,
Halleck.
Yes. The phone clunked down. Faintly, Billy could hear pots and pans crashing and bashing together. Someone was swearing in Italian. Someone else was laughing. Like everything else in his life these days, it all seemed very far away. At last, the phone was picked up.
William.
It occurred to Billy again that Ginelli was the only person in the world who called him that.
How are you doing, Paisan?
I've lost some weight.
Well, that's good, Ginelli said. You were too big, William, I gotta say that, too big. How much you lose?
20 pounds.
Hey, congratulations. And your heart thanks you, too. Hard to lose weight, isn't it? Don't tell me I know. Fucking calories stick right on there. Mixed like you, they hang over the front of your belt. Dagos like me, you discover one day you're ripping out the seat of your pants every time you bend over to tie your shoes.
It actually wasn't hard at all.
Well, you come on into the brothers, William. I'm going to fix you my own special chicken Neapolitan. It'll pull all that weight back on in one meal.
I might just take you up on that, Billy said, smiling a little. He could see himself in the mirror on a study wall, and there seemed to be too many teeth in his smile. Too many teeth too close to the front of his mouth. He stopped smiling.
Yeah, well, I really mean it. I miss you. It's been too long. And life's short, Paisan. I mean life is short, am I right?
Yeah, I guess it is. Ginelli's voice dropped a notch.
I heard you had some trouble out there in Connecticut, he said.
He made Connecticut sound as if it was someplace in Greenland, Billy thought.
I was sorry to hear it.
How did you hear that? Billy said, frankly startled. There had been a squib about the accident in the Fairview Reporter. Decorous, no names mentioned, and that was all. Nothing in the New York papers.
I keep my ear to the ground, Ginelli replied.
Because keeping your ear to the ground is really what it's all about, Billy thought and shivered. I have some problems with that, Billy said now, picking his words carefully. They are of an extra-legal nature. The woman, you know about the woman?
Yeah, I heard she was a gyp.
A gypsy, yes. She had a husband. He has made some trouble for me.
What's his name?
Lemke, I believe. I'm going to try to handle this myself, but I wondered, if I can't...
Sure. You give me a call. Maybe I can do something, maybe I can't. Maybe I'll decide I don't want to. I mean, friends are always friends, and business is always business. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Sometimes friends and business mix, but sometimes they don't, am I right?
Yes.
Is this guy trying to hit on you?
Billy hesitated. I'd just as soon not say too much right now, Richard. It's pretty peculiar. But yeah, he's hitting on me. He's hitting on me pretty hard.
Well, shit, William, we ought to talk now.
The concern in Ginelli's voice was clear and immediate. Billy felt tears prick warmly at his eyelids and pushed the heel of his hand roughly up one cheek. I appreciate that, I really do. But I want to try to handle it myself first. I'm not even entirely sure what I'd want you to do.
If you want to call, William, I'm around. Okay?
Okay. And thanks. He hesitated.